Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I am Dr. Mary Marcy. I am the president of Dominican University of California, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and the moderator for today's program. You can find us at commonwealthclub.org or download iPhone and Android apps for program and schedule information, as well as podcasts of past programs. But today, it is my pleasure to introduce a very interesting and very relevant program. The nonpartisan, nonprofit Commission on Presidential Debates has sponsored and produced all of the general election presidential and vice presidential debates since 1987, and planning is now underway for 2016. And even though we think of these debates as a regular part of the American political scene, few people understand the history or appreciate their scope and influence. A few facts might provide perspective. The U.S. presidential debates are, every 4 years, one of the most watched television programs in the United States, usually behind only the Super Bowl, and indeed one of the most watched programs in the world. Usually there are around 70 million plus viewers for each of the debates. And while it's easy to assume the debates have been with us since the Lincoln-Douglas debates that we all read about in high school civics, or at least since the infamous Nixon-Kennedy debate, in fact, the debates in their present format, or even the assumption that debates would always be held, is a fairly recent and refreshingly nonpartisan event. The Commission on Presidential Debates celebrated its 25th anniversary just last year, and one of its founders, Frank Fahrenkopf, joins us today. Finally, the debates are an inspiration to emerging democracies around the world. In the years without presidential elections, the Commission works with developing democracies. We will talk about all of these things, about the 2012 process and about upcoming debates, and I think we might hear a few stories from our distinguished guests. It is my distinct honor to introduce Mike McCurry and Frank Fahrenkopf. They're seasoned veterans of the political scene, and they are comfortingly familiar to much of the American public. Mike McCurry is probably most familiar to us from his time serving as press secretary to President Bill Clinton. In addition to that very public role, he has served in a range of high-level leadership positions for the Democratic presidential tickets since 1984, in addition to working with the U.S. Department of State and for such notable and significant national leaders as Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Harrison Williams, Jr. A graduate of Princeton University and Georgetown University, Mr. McCurry is currently a partner at Public Strategies Washington, where he provides counsel on communication strategies and management to corporate and nonprofit clients. Frank Fahrenkopf is also an old Washington hand, albeit mostly pitching for the other team. His most visible roles have included serving as chairman of the Republican Party for 6 of Ronald Reagan's 8 years and leading as chairman of the Republican National Committee longer than any person in the 20th century. Mr. Fahrenkopf was present at the creation of the Commission on Presidential Debates, founding this visionary effort along with Democratic National Committee Chairman Paul Kirk in 1986. He's a graduate of the University of Nevada, Reno, and of the Bolt Hall School of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. He is current president and CEO of the American Gaming Association. So I'll get us started and let you take it from there. Gentlemen, you clearly do not see eye to eye on most political issues, and you lead arguably the most successful nonpartisan effort in the nation, if not the world, through the Commission on Presidential Debates. So tell us a little about how that happened. Tell us about the mission and goals and how these fundamentally opposed visions of the American future came together around the commission.
Well, I'll start since I was there at the birth. As you pointed out, Mary, most people don't realize that we went 16 years from the Nixon-Kennedy debate to the next presidential debate. There was no way that Lyndon Johnson was going to allow Barry Goldwater to get up on a stage with him. He said, no way. And after Richard Nixon's experience in the 1960 debates with John F. Kennedy, he also was not interested in debate. So it wasn't until Gerry Ford was appointed president and was running against Jimmy Carter, that there was, in fact, debates. It started, it was handled then by the League of Women Voters. 4 years later, most people don't realize that I was at the first debate. It was in Baltimore. You know who the participants were? Ronald Reagan and John Anderson, a congressman from Illinois. Jimmy Carter refused to participate. Anderson was invited because the League of Women Voters said that anyone, you had to be at 15% in the polls to participate. Anderson was at 16 when the first debate rolled around. So Jimmy Carter said, I'm not going to debate if he's in it. By the time the second debate came around, Anderson had fallen to 12%, and Carter and Reagan had their only debate. And so that really began the takeoff point of the debates. Then in 1984, series of debates had a great deal of controversy with the media because the two candidates were given the right to veto the choice of moderators and panelists. And in those days, what they normally had was a moderator and maybe three or four reporters who asked the questions. And the two candidates vetoed over 90 reporters. So following that, there were two independent studies done starting in 1985. One was at the Institute of Politics at the Kennedy School at Harvard. The other was at the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University in Washington. Both of those committees were studying not just the debate process, but how we elect our presidents. Is there a better way to do it? Both of them independently came to the conclusion that there should be created an entity that exists for one purpose and one purpose only, to conduct general election debates every 4 years. Both groups came to Chairman Kirk, who was then chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and me, and we, in result, created the commission in 1986, and we began our 25-year run with the first debates in 1988 and have done every debate since.
Mary, that's the history, but I think what's behind that history is really important. There were two National Party chairs, Paul Kirk, who is my former employer and my predecessor as the co-chair of the commission, and Frank Fahrenkopf, who basically said, it is in the interest of the American people for us to set aside our partisan differences as Democratic chair and Republican chair in order to establish an independent commission that will guarantee that the American people get a look at the major candidates for president, whoever they may be, and not to favor one party or the other party, but to make sure that we have what we now have become accustomed to having, which is face-to-face encounters between our candidates for president. And that act of, it was probably a bipartisan act, but it was in fact kind of a nonpartisan act, is something that is so rare in the culture of our politics now. I mean, I can't imagine the Republican national chairman and the Democratic national chairman getting together on anything these days. But I think that savoring that moment of history in which people did something right for the interests of the whole country is something that we celebrate. And now the result of that is these debates have become more or less institutionalized. As Frank just said, it was not a given that presidential candidates would debate. My old boss, Bill Clinton, even ducked out of one of the debates in 1996. But I think now over time...
I thought he had a conflict.
I've been on both sides of this, on the candidate side and now on the commission side. So I know a little bit of the mischief that goes into this. But now, in 2012, was the first time an incumbent President Barack Obama very quickly agreed to all three of the debates that we had planned and proposed and said, you know, you pick the dates and you pick the format and you pick the venues and we'll show up. And I think that's an extraordinary achievement, and it goes to Frank and to his counterpart, Paul Kirk.
Well, what Paul and I agreed to, and Mike continues, and this sounds trite, but it's true. We said 25 years ago that in this work with the commission, I would never wear an RNC hat. He would never wear a DNC hat. We would always wear USA hats. And we kept that pledge, I think, and that's why we're still here.
I'd like to follow up a little bit on the wearing the USA hat part in an area that I don't think everyone is aware the commission is involved in. And that's the work the commission does in off years. So we all hear about the commission, and they're very visible during the years of presidential elections. there's a tremendous amount of work that goes on, not just in preparing the debates, but in actually using the debates to reach out to other countries when it's a non-presidential year. Could you talk a little bit about some of that?
Yeah, let me just describe a great occasion we had last week. Because people say, well, what does this Commission on Debates do? You know, you're only busy once every 4 years, so what do you do the rest of the time? We have a very committed staff led by an executive director, Janet Brown, and we are in partnership with one of the organizations that helps promote democracy around the world, the National Democratic Institute, although we've had help. There's a counterpart group on the Republican side that has helped us from time to time as well. But last week, in partnership with the National Democratic Institute, we gathered together all of the people who are just like me and Frank, who are debate commissioners from 19 different countries, ranging from...
I've got the whole list. Afghanistan, Argentina, Colombia, Ghana, Guatemala, Guyana, Haiti, Jamaica, Kenya, Moldova, Nigeria, Paraguay, Peru, Serbia, Sierra Leone, Trinidad and Tobago, Tunisia... Not bad.
And they are all countries which have now institutionalized some form of debates for their national leadership. Now, their situations are much different. As we heard the stories last week, sometimes they do their work at gunpoint. And whether or not a national broadcasting entity will actually air whatever debates they have. So it's extraordinary work, and everybody came together to share their best practices. And in fact, you know, I think it's important for the United States to be humble in situations like this. We actually learn some new things about techniques and formats and things from some of our partners from around the world who participate in this. So the work of this commission now has gone global, and we work with others who are in democratic societies are trying to promote the idea that those who seek national leadership positions ought to get together to have civil discourse and dialogue and compare their positions and confront each other on the issues that are important to the citizens of that country. So.
And it's gotten to the point now where the EU, for the first time, is going to actually have presidential debates in their run for who's going to lead the EU. I'll be going over to Europe in late September, and meeting with all the parties who are going to be involved in setting up a process for EU debates based upon...
You'll recall that in recent national elections in the UK, they had their first real kind of live televised debates, which was something new for them, and some of our staff went over to kind of help with the technical aspects of this, because in addition to just the fact of getting people together and agreeing that they will come and sit down and debate, there is enormous technical difficulties that go into putting these debates on. Many of the older folks in the audience here will remember that great debate in 1976 where there was, I think, 17 minutes where Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, and the whole lights went out and everything went dark and they didn't have any clue what they were supposed to do.
And they stood there for 17 minutes and didn't say a word to each other.
Yeah. And we have guaranteed that never happens again.
Well, there's a certain symmetry that in the worries about national discourse, that we're having a discussion with the Commission, which is serving as an international model at the Commonwealth Club, which is dedicated to civil discourse. But it must be an enormous challenge to bring these candidates together and ensure that there's a format that is fair and nonpartisan. We talked about the enormous television audience that the debates have and the enormous coverage they receive afterwards. So how do the candidates try and game the system, as it were? How do they attempt to influence the format of the debate?
Well,
that world has changed. When we started, Paul Kirk and I used to sit down with the campaign managers, and it was called the debate over the debates. And we would get in constant arguments with them back and forth. The candidates started to sign documents among themselves, a 37 to 40-page document. And at one time they came and said, you will sign this document and you'll get the moderators to sign the document. I told them very politely what they could do with the document.
Wasn't very polite.
That was the last time, realistically, that we have contact with. We choose the sites, we choose the dates, we choose the formats, and we made major changes in the formats this last time around, and we choose the moderators without any input whatsoever from the candidates. Now, some of the media still to this day, and those who are opponents, have say, well, the parties are running the debate. We have no contact, nothing to do with the political parties or the campaigns. We're private entities. We don't get any money from them. We raise our own money. We don't get any money from the federal government. And so we've reached that point. It was always two steps forward, one back over 25 years, I must tell you, of battles. But as Mike said, this last time, both candidates, not a word. And realistically, 4 years ago, both candidates, no difficulty whatsoever with them. And we'll make some changes. For example, we have always believed that the best way to do the debates is seated at a table. We've done a great deal of study, and we believe that the nature and tenor of discourse changes when people are seated. Podiums tend to be walls. But 4 years ago and just in the last debates, 6 years ago now, 2 years ago, the candidates came to us and said, we'd like to do one debate with a podium. So we'll allow them to have input around the margins, but not touch the tenor and real strength of the debate process that we've come up with. So it's been a battle.
Barack Obama may have preferred that he was not at that podium at that first debate in Denver last time.
He wasn't there, actually.
but the important point here is that while the campaigns, and I've worked obviously in national campaigns and worked, you know, with President Clinton when he ran for re-election in 96 and with John Kerry in 2004, and the campaigns want to tightly control everything about every single aspect of whatever public appearance the candidate is going to undertake. And we basically take the position, if we build it, you have to come. And we will accommodate you up to some point where, you know, if there are logistics or some things that we can tweak in the format that accommodate your interests as, to, you know, campaigns for, you know, the presidency, we will try to work with you. But the fundamental thing and the mission of the commission is to make sure we get something there that gives us that glimmer of insight, that moment where we see something about the character or quality of the candidate for the president that really helps us make a decision. You know, a lot of people are obviously in a very polarized political environment we're in now. They already know who they're going to vote for. But you get insights in these debates. You get something that suddenly triggers a moment where you say, I can now see what that person would be like in the Oval Office. And that's what we want. We want these to have the maximum value from an educational point of view for the maximum number of Americans. That's what we do. And, you know, we are open to how to do it better. I mean, we've, as you know, the evolution of these debates and the change in formats and how we've kind of moved the process along every 4 years, we are constantly looking for ways to improve it. And, of course, we are then heavily impacted by all of the things that happen in technology and all the different ways in which people now interact with these debates through social media, through the Internet, and through things that have changed technologically just in the time in which the commission has been working.
I mean, we've got a decision. As a commission, we're going to be dealing with. On election day, 40% of the American people had already voted. 40% of the American people had already voted on election day 2 years ago, with early voting in states, mail-in voting in some states. So we have to face the challenge. Do we have to move the debates back rather than running them up to a couple of weeks before the election? Because so many people have already voted. So as Mike says, there's changing technology that we've got to be sensitive to. As we go forward to make sure that we're reaching enough people. And you know, if you have children, I mean, most my kids, they don't have home phones. They have all with cell phones. And they don't watch the nightly news. And you can tell that if you watch the nightly news, I watch it, my wife and I, it's a whole bunch of ads for old people. You watch. You know, that two bathtub ad is on every night. And I'm telling you. And kids are, you know, they get it on the computer, you know. And so we have to be, and Mike is taking a lead on this with us.
Yeah, here,
we're
here in the heart of San Francisco, where high technology plays such an important part in the economy of this region. But how we use these debates to engage and interact with a community that now expects, because of the online experience, to be interactive is a challenge to us because we, you know, the format of these debates, you've all seen them, you all know, you got the big blue eagle in the background behind, so people know what to expect. It's kind of become one of those institutionalized moments in our democracy, like the State of the Union or the inauguration or the other big moments that we have, but we have to kind of hit the refresh button to make sure that we're using technology and reaching younger audiences, particularly that young demographic 18 to 29, that we want to engage and get more excited about citizenship. And that is the challenge that, you know, we are actively kind of working on now and talking to a lot of partners, some of them here in the Silicon Valley area, to really figure out how we're going to do a better job of fulfilling our obligation and our mission.
And because it's a Commonwealth Club audience, they also have a few suggestions for you. So I'm going to throw them out and let you react.
Not a surprise.
Not a surprise. I can't imagine you meet anyone in the United States that doesn't have a few suggestions
for you.
One of the thoughts that a couple of folks have is some concern that the debates are so visual that the commentary on them becomes about body language or whether the candidates seem to have slept well the night before, whether they're grumpy, or whether they're famously looking at their watch. So one of the suggestions is, could we go back to at least having one debate be a radio debate, or radio and podcast, perhaps, if we want to be in current technology?
Well, you know, what we've tried to do is we always bear in mind that we're not electing the best debaters. That's not the purpose of it. And that's why using a number of different formats where you can see the candidates in different formats present their case. But there's no question that if you see somebody, I mean, let's face it, those people who heard Nixon Kennedy on the radio all said Nixon won. Those people who saw it on television said Kennedy won. Because, you know, he came out with a great tan and Nixon looked like he hadn't shaved in 3 weeks. So that's always a part of it. But I think the visual is very important, because if there's one thing I've learned, now having done 26 of these things, is the American people want to like their president. And I have a theory, and I've talked to Mike about this, that lens, television lens, is very interesting. Some people can go right through that lens like butter. You have people like Ronald Reagan, people like Bill Clinton, President Obama. For some reason, they can get right through. Other candidates hit the lens and they bounce off. They can't get through. For some reason, they have trouble communicating. If you're going to be a leader, you've got to be able to communicate. You've got to be able to get through the lens. So I've always felt that doing a series of different formats, televising them, people, but you know, a lot of people do listen on the radio. I mean, a lot of people listen on radio or are listening streaming or whatever they may do. But I think that's the best way for people to make up their mind and make up their determination, as Mike says, as to whether or not they can see that person being in the Oval Office, being a leader, standing up to other leaders around the world in negotiations or whatever it may be. So I hear the argument. There may be some credibility to it, but I still think the way we do it is, from my view, is the best way.
You know, one of the things that we have learned from research about the debates is that people, as they hear commentary and they hear all the analysis and the punditry, their positions begin to be affected by what they hear in the commentary after the debate. There are some studies that indicate that if you put a people and put them in the room and ask them to just watch and listen to the debate and then record their opinions, it's much, much different than whatever they thought coming out of it is much different after they've been exposed to and bombarded by all the commentary afterwards. And I've thought about that a lot, because it is practically impossible to say, okay, people, don't tweet, just listen to these candidates, don't start arguing and expressing your own opinion until you've actually heard what these candidates have to say. That's practically impossible. It probably would be undemocratic to do that, because we want a vibrant debate, we want to encourage debate, but how do we get people to really focus in and listen and not just be, you know, consumed with the visual tics or some of the things that are distracting sometimes around these, the gasping, the sighing, the looking at the watches. I mean, we all kind of know what those references are historically, and how do we really think through what are these candidates actually talking about and what are they actually going to do once they're elected? I mean, that's kind of the heart of what the debate ought to be about. And, you know, how do you take these experiences they have when they come together? Now, our theory of the answer is that there should be a season of conversation. That's a phrase that our very able executive director, Janet Brown, came up with. But these debates are not isolated one-time events. It begins a conversation that ought to continue and ought to inform other aspects of the general election campaign as you move through the month of October and into the election period. And I think that there's something there that we have got to play with, which is it's not just about the visuals and that 90 minutes that they're together on stage. It's about what flows out of that and how do we compare the positions and how do we make them more substantive. And frankly, we've got work to do on that because we, you know, the commission can't compel candidates to show up and be substantive and address the issues and really talk about it. I mean, a great example of this that's very urgent right now is we had no discussion of global climate change in these debates in 2012. And what's the big topic today because of the president's address today, global climate change? And so, how do you get the substance of these debates to really help people inform and think about the choices that we have to make as a country? That's the ongoing process and the work that we have to do.
You know, there's several questions that not surprisingly talk about the role of the media. And I had the opportunity through the graciousness of the commission to attend the Denver debate last year. One of the things that struck me was the difference between what happens in the debate hall and what's known as the spin room. Could you describe what that looks like today, what it looked like 20 years ago?
I was actually part of the original Spinelli. It was the first debate between Ronald Reagan and Walter Mondale. It took place in Louisville, Kentucky, in the basement of the hall underneath. We were watching on television. It was Jim Baker, Mike Deaver, Ed Meese, some Californians I remember, myself, Senator Paul Laxalt of Nevada, Ed Rollins, another Californian from Chico, and we watched the debate. And you may remember at the end of that debate, President Reagan was wandering off up Highway 101 and was not his strongest moment. And the minute it was over, Jim turned off the TV and turned around and looked at us, and you could have heard a pin drop in that room. And Jim Baker looked at us and said, "We won! Now go out and tell the media we won." So we had to go out and spin the media. So we were kind of the first spinner. Now it is ridiculous. If you were there, there's what we call Spin Alley. And it's gotten so ridiculous that each side has maybe 20 spokespeople, governors or senators or members of Congress. And they have people walking around with them holding a sign up with their name on it, so that the media can see them in the crowd of people afterwards. It really has gotten to the point of really being ridiculous. And it's something that I want to spend some time on between now and the 2016 debates. Mike is 100% right. What we did for a few years, and we don't do it anymore, we used to have debate parties all over the United States sponsored by the commission. And people would gather in libraries, some in private homes and so forth, and there would be a moderator, a leader, that they would choose themselves. And the minute the debate was over, they would turn off the sound. So they wouldn't hear, you know, whether it was Sam Donaldson in the old days or Chris Matthews or whoever the heck it might be. And there was a discussion to ensue about what they heard, the good points and the bad points. And we found it to be fascinating, very different from people who then hang on and see not only the people in Spin Alley, the people who are, say they're experts, you know, you see them on television. I see people, every night I turn television on, it says, well, here is this Republican expert. I've never seen that person before in my life, and I've been around. Plus, the person is usually 15 years old. And I mean, it is amazing. But again, as Mike says, that's part
You're
of the...
You're sounding American, crotchety.
Yes, I am. I am crotchety.
Let me. I'll tell you a great story about the spin afterwards. In 1988, I happened to be... My assignment in the general election was to be the press secretary for Senator Lloyd Benson. And if you remember the debate between Lloyd Benson and Dan Quayle, it produced one of the most famous moments.
Omaha, Nebraska.
Omaha, Nebraska. And but it was very interesting because... those who were seated in the audience, including Senator Benson's wife, B.A., who's a lovely woman, came out of it and saying, oh my gosh, we lost the debate because Lloyd was so mean to Dan Quayle. Mm-hmm. And their impression from having been in there and watched it on stage was that this was a angry, he looked too angry and too hot. And of course, I was sitting with all my friends in the press and they were looking at it and watching this. Well, we then went back, as you, if you recall the sequence of, you know, news, John F. Kennedy was a friend of mine, Senator, you know John F. Kennedy, it's so famous. The camera was on Dan Quayle, getting his expression like caught, frozen, deer in the headlight. And I've always thought to myself that if it had been, if the camera had been reversed and it had been on Benson, that the outcome of that moment might have been judged a little bit differently. But the interesting thing was that all the people who came out said, how are we going to deal with this really, what they thought was a bad moment? And we said, I think we just won the debate in that moment. And so this spin room, that was a very complicated piece because a lot of people were asking, do you think, you know, the press was coming up to the Benson folks saying, do you think Senator Benson was maybe a little too over the top with that? And we said, no, we think that was clarified some of the distinctions between these two candidates. Now, frankly, it kind of is a demonstration that vice presidential debates are important and they produce moments, but ultimately they don't have a lot to do with the outcome of the general election because it's more about the candidates at the top of the ticket. But
I think we did win that one, as I recall.
Yeah, I think I unfortunately remember that you did. But this business of trying to go out and create commotion and commentary after the debate is out of hand now. And there's no way to, you know, control it, but it's becoming, you know, I think you all are the ultimate arbiters, because I think if you all turn all that off and tune it out and say, let's really talk about what mattered here to us as citizens, that kind of replaces the, you know, the cacophony and the Tower of Babel that you hear, you know, after the debate itself.
We've got a number of questions about the moderators themselves, everything from more detail about how they're selected to what I think of as the Jim Lehrer sympathy question, which is, can you just cut off the candidates' microphones if they talk over time, to some questions about fact-checking the candidates.
Let me talk to that, because I think that the commission, and I've said this publicly, really owes Jim an apology, and I apologize to him. The American people for so long had been used to a format where a question would be posed at a candidate, he would have 2 minutes to respond, the other candidate got 1 minute to respond to the candidate, and then there was a 30-second response, and then moved on to another subject. And I mean, that had been pretty much the format forever. We changed that with a series of debates that just concluded. And what we did is we divided the 90 minutes into six pods of 15 minutes. What we were looking for was to get more to have a debate, to have the candidates go at each other and actually look at each other. A lot of debates, they never look at each other, and go at it. And Jim's job was to get them started on one of the subject matters. And we announced the subject matter for each of the pods in the debate. So they knew. We weren't hitting them cold turkey with, you know, what's the name of the president of Uzbekistan, you know, as some moderators like to do. So they knew what it was going to be, say, on healthcare. And the plan was for 15 minutes. So we wanted them to go at each other. And they did. They went back and forth. Though a lot of people afterwards said, well, Jim Lehrer just let them go. He was supposed to let them go. He did exactly what we wanted to. Bob Schieffer did the same thing. And in the other debates, they were cut into time frames. So it's extremely important. But the bigger question is how we choose the moderators. And I will tell you that this time was difficult for us because we knew we were changing the format and we were going to these 15-minute pods. And it was very, very, very important that we have experienced people. You have no idea. You talk to anyone who's moderated one of these things, they're shaking going into this thing because there's 60 to 100 million people watching. And it was, so therefore we put Jim at the front and Bob Schieffer at the back. And then we went with Margaret and Candy, or not with Margaret, with Martha Raddatz in the middle. So, but we always try to get diversity. It's hard. You have to go a long way to try to find in any of the networks with Hispanics or blacks, men or women, who really are exposed enough to do this job. This is a tough, tough job. And so next time, clearly, we have to find a Hispanic. Next time, we have to find some younger people. And to attract that younger audience that Mike is so right, we have to communicate with. So it's a tough job.
Mm-hmm. The reality of what it takes to moderate a live television event at that level kind of takes out of play a lot of people who, you know, are great, brilliant print writers or people who would have other qualities and skills who could probably evoke from the candidates some interesting positions. But there's so much that goes into the theater of just running a live broadcast like that, that you pretty much have to go with prominent broadcast journalists who are at a very...
who are used to working with
level.
That thing in their ear.
Yeah, working with that thing in their ear. And that is hard. But that said, as Frank said, you know, we need to see and elevate and have people who represent the diversity of this country in the role as moderator. But the important thing is, it's not about the moderator, stupid. It's about the candidates, you know. And the candidates have got to show up, and they've got to debate, and they have to be prepared to engage each other and challenge each other, because the quality of the debate is going to be if the candidates who are there contest with each other to flesh out the opinions and the positions and the substance that matters. And, you know, frankly, if you get one candidate, like the Denver debate, I won't say that one candidate failed to show up, but he clearly had his honeymoon on his mind or something. But, you know, I think that...
it's his anniversary. Hopefully it wasn't
honeymoon. Yeah, anniversary.
It was his honeymoon. He fooled a lot of people.
He was remembering his honeymoon. That was the problem. But I think you do, you know, part of the responsibility goes to the candidates to say, are we going to, you know, draw out and flesh out some of the differences that exist in the different positions?
Mm-hmm. A related question is the question of fact-checking. And should it happen? When should it happen? Is it the moderator's role? And Candy Crowley famously did a bit of that. Is it the party's role afterwards? Is it the media's role? How do we...
It's the candidate's role.
Right.
It's the candidate's role. If one of the candidates says something which is not consistent, which is wrong, it's the other candidate. It's not for the moderator to interpose himself or herself, because then it appears as they're being partisan supporting one of the candidates. And that, unfortunately, did happen, in my view.
Frank and I mildly disagree. We are allowed to mildly disagree from time to time. And I think Candy was trying to move the program on. I've talked to her about it, and... I mean, I think some people thought she unfairly interjected herself when she basically corroborated something that President Obama was saying. But I think her view was that she had to kind of move into the next subject, and she was trying to close off what had become kind of a static conversation and move it into the next subject. But be that as it may, it's a great example of what we don't... We want moderators to get the candidates to engage. We don't want the moderators to be the subject of the debate after the debate. And that, you know, that's our goal.
The good thing to look at, that we looked at, that we did not want to happen and didn't, we didn't want them to be like the primary debates.
Right.
Which became circuses. Circuses. The Republican primary debates were atrocious. Now, to be fair, when you got 8 or 10 people on the stage, pretty hard to have a debate. I mean, you're lucky if everyone gets to speak for 3 minutes. But the way the networks played, the networks made a fortune. And, I mean, you had the absurdity of having a debate on a Saturday night in New Hampshire followed by a debate the next morning in New Hampshire. Same candidates. Sunday morning. It's just...
what the former Republican National Party chairman said when he declared his debates atrocious, what he meant to say was...
and they were also obnoxious, by the way.
But you can see exactly the kinds of the dilemma that we have, because you don't want these things. These are presidential debates, and there is a dignity and an expectation that comes with that now that elevates that beyond some of the more theater of the absurd that we saw in some of the primary debates. Now, on the other hand, sometimes those primary debates were very entertaining. And I think they were for their purpose, which is to help Republicans decide who they want to nominate. They may have helped clarify some things here and there. But when we move to the general election, remember, our commission only has responsibility for the general election debates. There is an elevation at that point, and it's a different atmosphere and a different context. I'm trying to bail you out there, buddy.
So a number of the questions ask about both the timing and the significance of the debates. I think there's been quite a bit of research done, actually, on how voters say they get information. Could you talk a little bit about the significance of the debates in the actual decision-making process? Does it harden people's positions? Does it actually influence their final decision?
Well, we know from polling that by the time we get to the general election, and remember, our debates started, the first one was, I think, October 3rd, and the last one was October 22nd. The number of undecided voters at that point is smaller. And that's because they've been exposed to a long length of time, the national party conventions, the primary phase of the campaign. And because we are increasingly becoming very polarized in our politics, Democrats know who they're going to vote for, Republicans know who they're going to vote for. But the fastest growing element of the electorate has been independents. And they, you know, they, while they're independents, they tend to either lean Republican or lean Democratic. So by the time you get to the October debates, there are very few that are truly undecided. But there are probably quite a number of voters, and it might range as high as 30% or so, that are either ambivalent or looking for something that says, I think this is my decision, and I'm looking for information that either confirms my decision or makes me think again. And I think that's the role these debates play. Now, the other thing is they provide enormously important glimpses into the personality, character, abilities of the people that we're going to elect. And it's part of a process that's different. You know, running for President of the United States is not like running for governor of California or U.S. senator or congressman. It's a different experience because we want, as Americans, to be personally engaged with the personality of the president. It's not like any other office. And I think part of what these debates do is that they solidify that relationship that the person that we eventually elect is going to have with the American people. It gives us some context to understand them and know who they are. We don't have kings and queens, but we have a president. And the relationship that we have with the president is a different one than with most of the other elected offices in the country.
Most of the polling that we've done, an independent polling, shows that about 65% to 70% of the people say that the debates are a factor in how they vote. It's not the only factor, but it's a factor. And minds can change. The numbers change dramatically after Denver. Not so much, I think, because the president wasn't at his best, but because suddenly they saw the governor standing there debating the issues and appeared presidential. It's always hard for a challenger, harder for a challenger to take on an incumbent. But he appeared presidential, he knew the issues, and it changed. No, so it can change views of voters. It changed it dramatically then, and the president had two more debates in which he could... He can recover. So they're extremely important, I think, in becoming more and more important. And as Mike shows, I mean, when we were running Ronald Reagan for president in 1980 and 84, we assumed automatically when we were doing our campaign plans that 40% of the people were automatically going to vote for the Republican candidate, 40% were going to vote for the Democratic candidate, and there was really only 20% of the voters in play in about 25 states, and that's where we concentrated. Those numbers have changed. Now, more people are independents, or say they're independents, than belong to either party, the Republican or Democratic Party. So there's a changing dynamic out there. So I think, as Mike says, it's very important, particularly with independent voters.
We've got a number of people who would like to hear some personal stories to the degree that you will tell them, either... whether you quietly in the back room score the debates yourself, even though you don't run out into the spin room, or whether you have times when you thought the candidates, rather than famous gaffes, times when the candidates were particularly themselves or said something that really presaged who they might be as president or vice president.
Well, I mean, there's some really interesting stuff. I mean, the first set of debates we did was Michael Dukakis and George Herbert Walker Bush. Well, George Herbert Walker Bush is about 6'3". Michael Dukakis is about 5'10", I think. And one of the great debates over the debate was, and they've used, back then, every debate was behind a podium. Well, the argument from the Dukakis campaign was that if the podiums were the same size, you know, there would be George Herbert Walker Bush, and there would be, you know, Governor Dukakis looking over. And so they reached agreement, which we didn't argue about, that the top of the podium had to hit the second button on their shirts. So we actually built a pitcher's mound behind Michael Dukakis' podium. So when Michael Dukakis came out, he stepped on the pitcher's mound, and therefore he appeared to be the same size. We've had, if you've ever been at one of these debates, it's very cold. It's about 65 degrees in the hall because you've got the cameras and the lights and so forth. And we had one, I'm not going to mention who it was, one candidate who was a sweater. He sweated all the time. And he wanted to reduce the temperature to 58 degrees in the hall. We said, nah, we're not going there. Okay, we won't do that. We had another candidate who was getting bald back here. We have seven cameras, and one of the cameras is in behind because it shoots at the moderator, who's normally in the middle, and he wanted to make sure we wouldn't shoot him from behind the shirt. I mean, there are a million of these, and some of them are, well, I'll tell you one more quickly. We're running out of time. But you remember in 1992 we had three candidates. It's the only time, because Russ Perot was involved. Now, historically, we do these on college campuses. And normally what happens is they do a draw. One of the candidates ends up, and we do them in gymnasiums usually, one of them ends up in the men's locker room. That's where they go before the debate, and their people are together, and they've got their briefing books, and the other goes in the women's. And so in 1992, we're at Wash U in St. Louis, and what were we going to do? There were three candidates. So we had to actually drill a hole in the floor of the basketball arena, where it was, and build a set there because you had to have restrooms and so forth. And so in came Governor Clinton with this guy holding briefing books and went in their holding room. In came President Bush. He went into his holding room, and we waited and waited, and Russ Perot just didn't come. So about 15 minutes before we went on air, I hear Russ Perot, and he's, Frank, what's this rule says I can't use charts and graphs? And he's joking because he knew. Russ Perot never went in the holding room, so Paul Kirk and I went in and used the facilities, so we couldn't say we did it for naught, and then we had to rebuild the floor of the state. I mean, so this is just little touches of things that went on. And one last one that hurts me, but the first town hall meeting was at Richmond. And at that town hall meeting, I was seated in a chair something like this. Paul Kirk was there. In the middle was a woman by the name of Pamela Harriman, who was on our commission. And she had a delightful voice. But we had in front of us a screen that showed what every television station was showing. And when Mike and Mary mentioned looking at the watch, when President Bush looked at his watch, every single screen showed it. Pamela leaned over to me. She put her hand on my wrist and said, Frank, darling, it's over. It's over. Turned out she was right.
As a longtime campaign operative, I always would watch the debates in a holding room with other campaign staff, and we could actually keep score. One of the consequences of being an elder statesman and co-chair of the commission is I have to sit with this guy now in the audience. But in the first debate that we just had in Denver, we were standing up. Frank and I go out at the beginning to tell people to turn their cell phones off and behave like a good average citizen.
Always tune in a half an hour early because we do our dog and pony
and
show.
And always thank C-SPAN. You to C-SPAN. C-SPAN is the only, they air that portion of it, so it's fun to do. So I'm standing up there and I'm looking down there at the seat that I'm supposed to sit in. And then I won't mention her name, but she is the Democratic Congresswoman from Denver. She had plopped herself down in my seat. And so I said, I'm looking at Frank saying, where am I supposed to go sit now? And so I said,
you're on your own, buddy.
So I walked up in the back and sat with the network guys, which was more, was more fun to do anyhow, because like Frank said, then you can watch all the way it looks on television. And of course, you know, for someone like me, it's less what is going on in the hall and more what is going on for the 80 million plus Americans who are watching this on television. But there are a lot of great moments that happen backstage, and one of them, which I remember I've seen happen a lot, is it's one of the rare occasions where the two campaign staffs who are, you know, in mortal combat during this campaign season come together. And it's always a refreshing opportunity because they get to meet their counterparts and there's a little bit of fraternizing goes on. Of course, everyone's at kind of a high energy level and nervous, but it is an opportunity for you to kind of see the other team in action. And, I wish we created more opportunities for some of them to actually have some conversation, because the only other time that they usually see each other is when they're squawking on television and yelling at each other. And I think we could probably, in the goal of creating more civil dialogue, you know, create more opportunities for them to get to know each other a little bit at these occasions.
One of the questions, which I think is very relevant to the history of the debates and going forward as well, is whether the dialogue has changed. We worry a lot about civil dialogue today. The Lincoln-Douglas debates were famous for their length and erudition. Do you think the last 25 years since the commission has been in place has seen a change in the dialogue at the debates, or has the political dialogue beyond the debates changed and influenced them in any way?
Well, I think the change in format has changed the dialogue. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the reasons we got rid of the panel of reporters was that reporter number one has thought long and hard about the question that he or she is going to ask, to show how bright they are to the American people and their constituents in the press corps. And so under the old rules, he or she would ask their question, and they would have the 2 minutes, 1 minute, 30 seconds. And maybe there needed to really be a follow-up on that question. But reporter number two has spent a lot of time on his or her question and doesn't want to waste his or her moment in the sun to follow up on, because they have their own question. So, and you didn't get the follow-ups when you should have. And that's why we decided to change the format. And I love this pod of 15 minutes on the subject where the moderator has the ability to follow up to get them to go at each other. So I think the system that we came through, and it's, as I said, two steps forward, one back, I like very much the model that we have now. Not that we might not change it. We're going to spend a lot of time with the commission studying what changes we should make, and we take a lot of, anyone has any ideas, don't hesitate to contact the commission. Go online to our website and be kind, but we're more than happy to hear from you.
Yeah, I really think that in that period of time, the quality of political discourse has really degenerated. No question about that. People are angrier. They use vocabulary that's much more mean-spirited. They question people's motives. They routinely call each other's liars, which is, you know, the most pejorative thing you could say in politics, which when I first started working in the United States Senate in the 1970s was forbidden that you would ever use that word in connection with a colleague in the Senate. But the refreshing thing about these debates is when two candidates have to sit there face to face, it's pretty hard for them to use that kind of language and to use that kind of tone, and you quickly get into it. They might be sharp in their exchanges, and they might look for moments where they try to crystallize what the differences are, those sound bites that become so important in the coverage after the debate. But they, by and large, have to sit there and look like they're having a conversation about the future of the country. Otherwise, we would all be offended, right? So that's part of what the importance of these debates is. They reinforce the candidates for the highest office in the land to model some kind of behavior that reflects what we would want in the sense of good citizenship in a discourse about the future of the country.
One of the problems that we have in Congress right now is that there's about 230 Republicans, give or take. It's hard to keep track because people retire in special elections and so forth. And of those 230, 93% of them were elected from districts carried by Governor Romney. There are roughly 205 Democrats in the House. 96% of them were elected in districts carried by President Obama. Which means if you're in the House and you're an incumbent, if you win the nomination, you're home free, because these are so locked up because of gerrymandering that your challenge is really in the primary. And if you're a Republican, you normally get run at from the right. If you're a Democrat, you get run at from the left, and it pushes you in the positions. So what's happened is there's no middle ground anymore in Congress, particularly in the House. There are no more blue dog Democrats who were sort of in the middle. There's no longer moderate Republicans who used to be from the Northeastern core. They're gone. And so without the middle, there's no way to go forward. These people don't know each other. I jokingly say that the most dangerous place in Washington is Thursday night at Ronald Reagan Airport. Because if you're not careful, you'll be stampeded by the members running for airplanes going home to campaign. They don't know each other. If you don't know someone, you can't trust someone. If you can't trust someone, you can't sit down, go across party lines, be brave enough to face the criticism of MSNBC or Fox News. So it's tough. It's tough. We think we've taken, in this terrible, terrible toxic atmosphere, at least the presidential debates are out of there because of the very nature of how we've structured them. And again, as Mike says, it's really up to the candidates. But I think that our record is we've had people who've been involved in very serious and courteous discourse.
Just a brief pause for our radio listeners to say that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guests are Michael McCurry, former press secretary to President Clinton, and Frank Fahrenkopf, the former chair of the Republican Party under President Reagan. They are also co-chairs of the Commission on Presidential Debates, and we are discussing those debates and political discourse in America. I want to pick up on what you just mentioned, Frank, about the number of things that actually go right at those debates, because I want to go back to the conversation about working with other nations. We hope, I think often hope but aren't sure in this country, that there are some things we do well in our democracy that are worth emulating. And then we worry that we've overstepped those bounds or we've become too sure of ourselves. It does appear that the debates are one thing that we're getting mostly right, at least in the view of the rest of the world. Can you talk a little bit about what those countries are most interested in learning from the ways in which the debates are held, from the process itself, and whether you see it affecting their democracies in a positive way?
I'll let Mike, he just was with them while I was in Europe. I was missing the meeting. So.
It's interesting. Their concerns, you know, our format and how our debates have evolved are unique to our political culture. And I think it would be a little bit too much hubris for us to say that we have this great model and that you should emulate that, because they are all struggling with much more fundamental questions like, you know, how do we get national broadcast entities to air debates because the government in power can turn the power off and shut them down? And how do we guarantee that, you know, that the electorate will actually see them? How do we encourage, you know, leaders in power to participate and face their opponents face to face? I mean, just and you know, as Frank recounted the history in our system, that's not always been a given in our system either. So they're looking at, and then the third thing is, how do we create an independent structure like a commission, like our Commission on Presidential Debates, that will have the integrity necessary to compel people to participate in these events? So they are looking at the very fundamental building blocks of what it takes to encourage debates at the national level for national leadership. And they do so in conditions of extreme violence in some places, where the tensions of elections will spill over in the streets and people will die. I mean, this has happened, you've read the news, you understand enough of the context there. And many of them, the most refreshing thing one said was, if we bring these debates in and let our people see our leadership arguing together about the future of the country, it will save lives in the streets because the violence in and around our elections won't spill out. I mean, that's a pretty profound comment on the importance of these kinds of encounters in any civil society, any democratic society. So, you know, I think we always need to be careful about assuming that the United States of America has the paradigm that everybody else should apply. But I think what they are learning from seeing our experience is, how do we develop uniquely in our own political cultures models that will work and things that will, you know, encourage people to say, well, we have to do this because this is what really civilized societies do. This is what civilized democratic societies do.
What I always start with is, look, don't try to emulate the United States. You have to come up with a system that fits your culture, your mores, your heritage. You know, when I for the past 3 presidential races have lectured at universities in China, in both Beijing and in Shanghai. And to try to get those students to understand the Electoral College.
Try to get U.S. people to understand the Electoral College.
Don't take our system as being the perfect system. You have to do it within the framework of your culture. And that's the way to go. And that's our approach always.
In most of these societies, they're of course parliamentary systems. So they're dealing with parties that are listed on a national ballot. And so they have all kinds of different questions about who participates and how many participate and how do you structure it. So, but it's refreshing to see how much innovation there is and how many interesting ideas and different ways of handling certain things come out of some of these conversations. Things that, frankly, might kind of inform the way we do our debates here. So it's a very important, you know, global dialogue, I think.
And the last question, I admit not a disinterested one. As you know, I'm the president of Dominican University. The selection of debate sites is not a small matter.
I knew we were going to get this question.
No, it's not about the past, but it is about why you choose colleges and universities as opposed to other sites. And whether site and location matters. Sitting in California, one of the more dynamic economies, not just in the country but in the world, we've had a couple of presidential debates in California in the past. Does location matter, and why colleges and universities?
We started out, and it's still our mantra, that we're involved in educational function. And we just started out and saying we're going to do it on university campuses. And if you're ever there and see what it does to a college community, it's just incredible what it does to the students. And so we've continued to do that. We try to get geographical balance. We try to do a site in the West, one in the Northeast, one in the South, and one in the Midwest. Doesn't always work that way. It's because sometimes the proposals that come in don't meet the standards. There are very strict standards on hotel rooms within a certain distance. You know, you'll have 10,000 reporters there from all over the world covering. You have to have a facility not only to house where the debate is, but a facility to take care of the reporters from all over the world who are there. You have to feed them. I mean, there are a lot of things that go into the process. There are also, in the final cut, when we sit down, is the Secret Service. We normally get it down to about 10 or 12 places. And the Secret Service goes with us out. They have to know that it's security, that they can lock it down, that there are easy escape routes where they can move the candidates. So it's a very, very serious matter. Now, whether or not it matters to a state and how a state's going to vote, I don't think so. It used to be, when I was chairman, the big, where are we going to hold the convention? Convention. If we hold it in Florida, we'll win Florida. If we hold it in California, we'll win. Neither party has that worked out. I mean, so I don't think the location really impacts that much the voting that goes on in that state. But we try to get that geographic balance. And, you know, we've been to we went to a campus again. I won't mention, I had a brand new multi-million-dollar theater for the performing arts. I mean, it was state of the art. They still had to put in $500,000 worth of additional lighting and air conditioning because of the demands of the cameras and the lights when you're doing national television. So it's a lot of intricacies that go into the choice.
The only thing I would add to that is we actually have some students from the Junior Statesman program who are here in the audience here. The other thing is it's the students, and it's the young people. They are so excited and so idealistic. In fact, a lot of the universities and colleges that sponsor the debates with us develop curriculum so that their students actually study the history of debates and they get into it. But it's that idealistic element that you're going to get some sense that this is about the future of our country and here's the future and the students that are represented here that kind of makes the whole opportunity really refreshing as well.
The only thing left for me to do is to point out that I think it's usually attributed to FDR, but I think it's variously attributed. It's said that there's no higher calling than public service. And we've been honored to have two public servants of the United States here this evening, and I would like you to join me in thanking Frank Farrakhan and Mike McCurry.
Thank you. Thank you. Great job.
Thank you. And now to close, I am still Dr. Mary Marcy, the president of Dominican University of California, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.